You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a 2010 interview from the archives with Vermont author Tim Brooks. Here's Tim's bio as he wrote it for his website. Quote, I was born in a small house in London of parents who were poor, honest, and liked going for very long walks, preferably in the rain. My education consisted of being forced to take written exams every 5 or 6 weeks and to eat school lunches of liver and onions until I got to Oxford, where we had written exams every 8 weeks and had lunches of pickled onions and Guinness. This was quite enough to make me flee the country and seek gainful employment in Vermont, where I have lived for 29 years, writing a great deal and trying to grow good raspberries. Only one of my books has been translated into another language. It appeared in Dutch as Geen plek om in co quidget te rocken. My favorite color is russet. If I had my life all over again, I would take more risks, like smuggling the liver out of the dining hall wrapped in my handkerchief. That's from Tim Brooks' website, from his bio. He's a very funny guy. I have enjoyed speaking with him on two occasions for two different interviews. Today, you're going to hear the second of those from 2010, during which we discuss his book, 30% Chance of Enlightenment, as well as some of his other projects, which include the professional writing program at Champlain College in Burlington and something called the Endangered Alphabets Project, which consists of an exhibition of carvings and writings which attempt to bring attention to the issue of disappearing languages and the alphabets in which they are written. Tim Brooks has written 11 books, if I counted correctly, and they are A Hell of a Place to Lose a Cow, A Warning Shot, Catching My Breath, Endangered Alphabets, Guitar, An American Life, SARS, Behind the Mask, Signs of Life, The Driveway Diaries, The End of Polio, The Story So Far, and 30% Chance of Enlightenment. When I spoke to Tim in 2010, I started by asking him to talk about how he came to write the book 30% Chance of Enlightenment. He began his answer by reading an excerpt from the book.
All travel stories set out with good intentions. The best, though, involve a shipwreck. The good intentions run onto hidden rocks, not on the chart. The old familiar self is wrecked and drowns. A new self fights its way to the surface, blinking and astonished. Changed in utterly unpredictable ways, this is just another of those stories.
I love that.
And that's really what happened, because I'd been working to get an assignment to go to India to watch the monsoon come ashore, because I had read Alexander Freitas' book, Chasing the Monsoon, and I thought, oh, I want to do that. And so I pitched that idea to all kinds of people, and they all said, no, we're not spending huge amounts of money to send you to India. And then National Geographic contacted me, and they said, we want to do a story on weather forecasting. So I said, oh, well, you must send me to India, because the premier act, or the epic act of weather forecasting, is the monsoon forecast in Asia, especially in India. And what I didn't realize was that Freitas was actually wrong about a lot of things.
He was the author of the book that you
Chasing the Monsoon, exactly. But nevertheless, I did my pitching bit successfully enough. They said, okay, good, so go to India, watch the monsoon come ashore, and then interview the meteorologists about this epic act of weather forecasting. By the time I got to actually watch the monsoon come ashore, which I saw and was an extraordinary sight and is described in the book, I had actually, without my knowledge, been banned from every office of the India Meteorological Department. And so I found myself in southern India, not knowing anybody. I'd been sent there specifically to interview meteorologists, and I couldn't interview meteorologists. I was due to be in India for another 12 days or something, and National Geographic had spent more money to get me there than all the expense budgets I'd ever had and all the stories I'd ever done before put together. And it was like, oh, what now? So
can you describe the moment of discovering that you'd been banned?
Well, we knew that there was something brewing because for some time before I left, I'd been getting these emails from the assistant to the director general, very much kind of a high priest in the Indian bureaucracy. And this assistant had been saying, you do realize that you will need government permission to make your film. And of course, I wasn't making a film. And so first of all, I emailed back and said, well, I'm not making a film. I'm just going as a journalist. National Geographic has already contacted the Indian embassy. We have all permission. Everything is fine. So then he would get back and say, yes, but you need government permission to make your film. And so then my editor got back and we got in touch with the Indian embassy. And they said, we have no idea what these guys are talking about. And this escalated to the point where several things happened. One was that as I got on the plane to fly to India, without my knowing it, the State Department ordered all U.S. citizens out of India because Pakistan had just been testing nuclear weaponry and India had just moved 1 million troops to the border. And I didn't know this, luckily. So I was in the plane heading east while all the white guys on the subcontinent were heading west.
And you did know that this was all brewing, but you didn't realize it had hit that stage.
Yeah, and the business with the meteorological department, I had actually talked by email with the high priest himself, and he had given me this very strange message which didn't say yes or no. But it didn't say no, you know, and so we thought, well, we'll go ahead. And the objection made no sense. So what happened was that the first night I was down in southern India was when the monsoon hit. It was just an extraordinary coincidence. The following morning, when everything had changed and the air was now 100% humidity and the temperature had come down a little bit and all the sort of the wildlife had changed, the foliage had changed, it's just amazing. We went to the observatory in Trivandrum, which had been built by a Maharaja specifically so he could watch the monsoon coming across the Arabian Sea. And when I got there, Dr. Gangadharan, who was in charge of the observatory, said, I'm terribly sorry, I've been given strict instructions, I'm not to talk to you. And he was clearly a very bright guy and a very nice guy, but it was also clearly more than his job's worth to, you know, disagree with his superior. So I fell into this sort of deep anxiety funk. And luckily, I'd been put in contact by a friend of mine I play cricket with, an Australian guy, who said, you know, mate, if you're ever in India, you should see this friend of mine. Her name's Faith. She runs this spiritual travel agency. And so for the rest of the time that I was in India, I was literally traveling on Faith's instructions. You know, I was
And she's a spiritual tour guide, so her name is very apt.
Oh, yes. And in fact, there's a chapter in here called Faith's Gate, where where I was watching some things that were happening at her, literally at her front gate. The resonances were all over the place, because essentially it does become a spiritual journey. And if you like, I can read you a little piece at some point
that
really illustrates
yeah.
that.
I also love how the very beginning part, which you already read, the whole idea of travel becomes its own metaphor because your journey turned out to be something other than what you had originally intended.
And this really fits in with my notion that I use in class all the time, which is that all writing is travel writing. Because, first of all, if you, as the writer, don't leave your zone of comfort in writing something, then what you write is pretty much not worth reading. But equally, you have to remember that you've been there wherever there is, and the reader hasn't. Mm-hmm. So you have to write about it as if you're a travel writer. And the same is true if you're a novelist, if you're a poet, etc. In every instance, it's really a form of travel writing.
Mm, that's interesting. I like that. Well, why don't you go ahead and read
sure.
the book? I think it'd be great.
Okay, so this is a passage by now. I am in the city of Madurai, which is in sort of central southern India, in the state of Tamil Nadu. And as with most instances, things did not go well, but that turned out to be the right thing to have happened. The book starts out being about weather forecasting. And after a while, and that was what National Geographic was really interested in, and after a while, I began to think that this whole issue of the science of weather forecasting was missing the point. That the point was not really how do we get the information, but what do we do with the information?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a spiritual question. It's what are you going to do with your life?
Mm-hmm.
Also, it struck me that weather forecasting was humankind's most ambitious attempt to foretell the future.
Mm.
And the amount of money that's spent on weather forecasting is utterly extraordinary. And interestingly enough, if you took that same amount of money and instead you spent it on making sure that people, especially in the developing world, had good clean water supplies, then, you know, 80% of the world's disease would be cured. But instead we use it to do things like, for example, I interviewed windsurfers who have feeds to their cell phones which automatically let them know when the wave height at any of their local beaches that they've identified reaches a certain height and the wind reaches a certain
Wow.
number of knots. And this is the contemporary use in the United States of weather forecasting. The second part of the book is called Monsoon, where I really get much more interested in what the monsoon really means, because I realized that once I was in India, that's what I needed to do. I couldn't talk to meteorologists. I had to talk to ordinary Indians.
Mm-hmm.
What does the monsoon mean to you? What does the monsoon forecast mean to you? And I began to realize that no Indians pay the slightest attention to the monsoon forecast, and it has no impact on their lives whatsoever. So my original reason for going there was, in fact, completely bogus. But, of course, if I had been able to interview the meteorologists, they would have said quite the opposite, and I would have been utterly misled. The third section is all about water,
uh-huh.
and it's really about the nature of water, the importance of water, and even to some extent the spiritual nature of water. So I'm going to read you a little bit which is really all about that. So we're in Madurai, and we're going to go and see the usual kind of tourist sites. And this chapter is called The Elephant in the Sentry Box.
Okay.
Faith had arranged for a tour of the city, led by a local guide called Mr. Prince, a tall, solidly built man with a knowing eye and an oddly intimate manner. When he decided I needed to know something, he would sidle up close, lean over, fix me conspiratorially with his knowing eye, deliver a swift, dull lecture in a rapid mutter, and then look at me knowingly again, as if he had delivered some state secret. He was also a Christian rather than a Hindu, and whenever he told me about some aspect of Hindu religion, he threw me the knowing eye again, as if to suggest that we Christians, of course, agreed that this Hindu stuff was a bit, well, tribal. Tribal is the insult that the Indians use when they want to look down on someone. It means primitive. It means backward. This strange manner confused me terribly. The longer our tour went on, the more I desperately wanted to tell him to shut up and go away. But every time he leaned toward me, his eyes fixed on me, I was paralyzed all over again. I felt like an unusually suggestible cobra being trained by an especially charmless charmer. So Mr. Prince takes us to these various places, and I'm kind of interested in this question, why is this particular river holy? And then I start discovering actually that all rivers are holy. I had asked Mr. Prince why the river Vaigai was holy, thinking still in biblical terms, assuming that a single god had viewed this river with favor rather than some other for the usual disturbingly capricious reasons. And ever since, rivers had been divided into the blessed and the cursed, the sheep and the goats, the quick and the dead. But no, it was all much simpler and made much more sense. Rivers bring water, water brings life. And perhaps in a deeper sense, water is life. Rivers are therefore holy. The more water, the more life, the holier the river. At once, this dry river and the longing and desolation around it no longer seemed like a geography lesson or even a religion lesson. It seemed like a biology lesson, but a biology lesson of an unusually profound kind. Out of nowhere, I remembered going into an elementary school in California and seeing on the wall a long vertical poster depicting the evolution of the five kingdoms of species. Called the Ladder of Life, it showed Animalia, Plantae, Protista, which is plankton, Monera, bacteria, and fungi, as branches sprouting from a double helix that twisted upwards, and at the foot of the helix, as if accompanied by a small exclamation, blink, was a single drop of water.
Hmm.
So we go over to the palace, and outside the palace is this thing that they call a pit. They use the word pit and the word tank, especially the word tank, to mean something different from what we use the word tank. A tank would be an artificial pool. Our first stop was the pit where the sand was dug for the palace, which one of the kings of Madurai had converted into a tank or ornamental lake. Not an ornamental lake in the European fashion with trees and little island with a Palladian temple or a gazebo, but a vast rectangle, the terraced slopes all round painted in vertical red and white stripes. In the center was a temple island, yes, but in the classic Indian style. Every January, on festival day, Mr. Prince muttered, a float carried images of Lord Shiva and his wife, Lady Parvati, who in Madurai was called Meenakshi, the green goddess, the fish goddess, the goddess of fertility. At the time, I didn't really grasp the implications of Mr. Prince's lecture, but later I was stunned. How much water did that vast tank hold? How on earth did they fill it? Was it full all the time, or did they fill it only for ceremonial occasions? And if the latter, did they give the water away afterward, distributing it pitcher by pitcher among the poor? When was it last filled, and why was it now dry? What an extraordinary display that ceremony must have been, a display that combined the political and the religious, because that much water must have represented a vast fortune in such an arid region, like the swimming pools of the early Californian millionaires. And the tank itself was a curious kind of negative architecture. The city's sacred towers and temples rose above the skyline, embossed with the usual ornamentation of carved deities and symbols, but the tank was probably in its way as vast as any of them, yet sunk into the ground, its structure and shape that of the water that filled it, the sun sparkling off the wavelets on its surface. For the first time I saw that a body of water might in itself be a temple. Not a Hindu temple, but a temple of a far older religion from which Hinduism had wisely borrowed. One last little bit here. So then we leave the palace and we go over to the largest temple in the city, which of course is a temple to Lord Shiva. The temple, like many Hindu temples, was a steep, truncated pyramid, terraced and encrusted with statues. To me, increasingly sweaty and tired of Mr. Prince, it looked like a vast beehive. Yet even here, I was taken aback by water. At the heart of the temple was a ceremonial pool, its terraced steps striped red and white. The water took on the blue of the cloudless sky and passed it on to us as if acting as a translator, as if reminding us that the celestial truth was there, even if we neglected to look up at it. Small clumps of weed grew in cracks in the tank wall at the waterline, demonstrating that the water could casually throw off life like a series of sketches, even in captivity. The water was shallow and looked brackish, but of course it was constantly evaporating, leaving its contaminations behind. The miracle of water is that it undergoes constant reincarnation. The pool at the heart of the temple implied that somewhere in its most ancient past, Hinduism had grasped the fact that the hydrological cycle is a central metaphor of what happens to all of us, to all earthly life. We condense out of an invisible state, taking on solid but flexible form, obedient to time, gravity, and the other habits of physics. And then at the appropriate time, we evaporate back into the more ethereal state, in the process shedding all the impurities we've picked up, clean and light, ready to be reborn. Compared to the pool, the surrounding pillars and graven images seemed dry and brittle. the material manifestations of a material world, no more than symbols for something that the water itself supplied effortlessly.
Thank you very much. So it sounds like it was an incredibly transformative experience for you. And I'm curious, coming back home, are you still aware of water in this new way?
Very much so. And in fact, I talk about the United States as the land of weather fear. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways in which I was most aware of this is that when I got back, I had left really before the Vermont spring had really got going. Mm-hmm. And when I got back in mid-June, it was in that classic kind of eruption stage, and the greenery on both sides of the little dirt driveway at our house had just bulked out so much that the car would be kind of scraped by it on both sides as you went the drive down the driveway, and the vegetable garden wasn't tiny little sprouts, it was suddenly this huge bushy thing. And there was heavy rain going on at the time, and people were saying, oh, you know, this is a disaster, this is a catastrophe. And in fact, it was life. It was life at its fullest. And a wonderful thing happened, which is that at the time, my younger daughter, Maddie, was about 7. And about the third day I was back, there was this heavy rain, and she pulled open the sliding door onto the deck, and she went out and she danced in the rain.
Hmm.
And that's exactly what I had seen in India, a sense that because you have such a dry period and such heat, you sort of recognize the importance and the value of water. And of course, growing up in England, as I did, you know, where there's this kind of drizzly stuff all the time, you don't think about the importance of water at all.
Yeah.
And so really ever since then, I really equated water with life.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also realized that water is generous in a way that humans don't really like to believe in. So, for example, if you have flooding, then you have all of these waterborne diseases flourishing in the floodwater.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in a hot place like India, you also have, parasites and all this kind of stuff. And, of course, we like to believe that's a bad thing. But of course, for the parasites, this is a really good thing. So water really has that divine quality of being even-handed, you know, unlike, you know, the Christian or the Jewish faiths, which really tend to say, you know, well, you know, the God has his favorites. Water is really much, much more divine in the sense that, water is about life and all forms of life in an impartial sense.
Yeah, yeah. There's actually an expression in Hebrew, Mayim Hayim, and it means living water, and it's about water being life.
Mm. Yeah, in fact, there's one point where I start thinking of humans as being vehicles for water, being transportation devices that water has invented. And it really, an amazing thing happened where I was actually in Trichy, which is where faith was based. And I had been to a vegetable market, and that following day I was thinking, boy, I had begun realizing that without water there's no color, that without water there's no taste, and the vegetable market was the most crowded place in the whole city. And I thought, boy, you know, that's also probably the place where there's the highest concentration of water.
Mm.
And I thought, I wonder if water seeks out water. If you think of creatures as being water transportation devices, then, you know, I wonder if there's a sense in which, you know, water seeks out water. So I went there, which was, of course,
It was on your windscreen.
I did a classic Mad Dogs and Englishmen thing. I said, okay, I've got to go back to that that market. And so my guide and driver and friend Rajesh was kind of like, this guy's nuts, but he drives me there. And I discovered that I was even righter than I thought, because the vegetable market is a hollow square. But what I hadn't realized is in the middle of the hollow square is a tank.
Huh?
Is actually another of these pools full of water. And so overhead, the kites, the birds are sort of wheeling, and everyone is all around there. And it was as if all of these forms of life were as close as possible to the source of water.
That's neat. And this actually, what you're just talking about reminds me of a quote I was going to mention from the book. Weather is ineffable. It's all about light, or the restrictions of light. Light struggling to reach us, light bathing us, light without which no revelation is possible, light the opposite of blindness. Or it's about water, which is life made visible, life coalesced, the currency of life. Or wind, invisible, constant, the ambassador of change and time. Weather is greater than us, unpredictable, disrespectful, majestic, an expression of the peculiar properties of water, the turning of the planet and the brilliance of the sun. I loved that.
I wish I could write like that.
That was really wonderful. The funny thing is that on the show I've started announcing the sunrise and sunset times, and then announcing how much more sunlight we got in the last week since the last show. I did it originally because I was just so light deprived.
Of course.
But reading your book made me feel like maybe I'm missing the point. I should stop mentioning all the statistics and just look out the window. Tell people to look out the window.
And that's really where the title comes from. I was in Bombay, and most of the channels on Indian television are extraordinarily benign.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come across one of the American channels and there's, you know, World War III about to take place, or there's rape and murder and all kinds of other just horrific stuff. And I was on one of those channels and a weather forecast came on. You actually never see weather forecasts on Indian television. I'm sorry, it wasn't a weather forecast. It was a promo for a weather forecast. So it was like a forecast of a forecast. And I think it was maybe CNN. And the tagline was, be informed, be the first to know. And I thought, why? So I can run down the street yelling, 30% chance of showers, 30%, like Paul Bunyan. And I thought, this is utterly ridiculous. And that then became, you know, I thought, so let's turn this completely on its head, and it became 30% chance of enlightenment.
Which is a great title. Now, I'm curious, did the National Geographic use any of what you found over there?
No.
No.
I wound up doing the story, but what I found over there was, first of all, not their kind of story, because they really wanted a high-tech story. They wanted a story about developments in this that lead to that.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually wound up finding a whole bunch of those and some very interesting stuff, almost exclusively in the U.S. And the other thing was that it really complicated the picture in that it really raised profound questions about our dependence on weather forecasting.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you know, if you decide you're going to build a million-dollar house on Cape Hatteras, then instead of people coming up to you and saying, you're an idiot, you know, there's a hurricane or a tropical storm here every single season, don't do it. Or let's have a zoning ordinance that says, you cannot do it. You can only have a house that if it blows down, you can rebuild in 24 hours, or something like that. You know, that way there's no waste involved. Instead, we put the million-dollar house there, and we say, right, we now need to have hurricane predictions that are so accurate and so advanced that we have time to evacuate the entire Outer Banks if it's going to get hit by a hurricane. It's completely backwards. And I have this, I had this kind of insight moment, this epiphany, before I left, when I was watching a squirrel, and it was in a bird feeder that I had made, which was really more like a bird house, but it was suspended from a branch of a tree so it could swing, right? So the squirrel is hanging on with its little claws, and the birdhouse is swinging back and forth, and the squirrel kind of runs in through one of the little doors and gets some seed and runs out again. And I thought, what if it weren't just a wind? What if it were a hurricane? What if, well, first of all, the squirrel is probably still going to be able to hang on. It's got some pretty decent claws there. Secondly, if the hurricane blew down the Scotch pine where the tree's nest is, probably, that squirrel could rebuild that nest in probably 24 hours, I would
mm-hmm.
imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a question of the squirrel being perfectly adapted to its setting and its potential weather conditions. We're not like that. And in fact, the further humankind, quote, evolves, unquote, the further we get from that condition. We demand more and more complex structures to make our lives workable. it's that fragility and those choices of those demanding choices that mean that we need to invest more and more in our attempt to predict the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed the idea that the weather forecasting has become almost a sort of a threat of violence to our public and a pastime and an entertainment.
Well, just recently, one of the commercial weather services, who are always exaggerating the degree of threat, invented this term snowicane. And that's just a perfect example. First of all, there is a perfectly good word, blizzard. You know, blizzard means snow with high wind. Secondly, under most circumstances, that kind of situation is completely manageable. I mean, it may mean you can't get to work. It may mean that, you know, if you do too much shoveling too hard, then you may have a heart attack. But frankly, I got caught in, quote, the storm of the century, unquote, with my daughter Zoe flying back from New Mexico. And we actually had a wonderful time. And by the time we got back, there had been so much snow in Vermont that everybody had been building these snow tunnels through the snowbanks, and it was the most wonderful time. It was a brilliant day, and all the neighborhood kids were kind of burrowing through these tunnels. Normally, there isn't that much snow, you know. And it's all because first of all, they need to sell their services as being important, and secondly, the television channels need to sell the sense that, you know, you have to watch them, otherwise something dreadful is going to happen.
Mm-hmm. One thing that happens in this book and in some of your other books is there's a lot of humor, and some of the stories that are funny have as the butt of their joke actual people that have done silly things. For example, the man from England who replied to your email by correcting your use of the subjunctive, which was just hilarious, and he didn't answer the question that you had asked him. So I'm curious, when you are going to represent one of those situations, do you change the names of the people, or do you just go ahead and use the people's real names?
Well, the person who is most frequently the butt of my humor is, of course, me.
Yes.
And so, for example, in my book, The Driveway Diaries, I say there is no hero to this book. There is a villain and an idiot. You know, the villain is my driveway and the idiot is me. And I actually don't like the fact that someone like Bill Bryson, for example, makes a lot of his humor at the expense of other people that he meets. There are very few people in this book, probably three, about whom, you know, whom I make fun of to any degree.
But and I will clarify, what I mean is you just present what happened, and
right,
they did things that make them look silly, basically.
Again, I would say there are probably three. Mostly, especially when I'm traveling, I'm so aware of the kindness of strangers and the vulnerability of the traveler, which in turn brings out the kindness of the strangers. I usually think that it would be uncool to the point of cruel to be making fun of anybody. So Mukhopadhyay, who's the director general's assistant and the director general himself, I basically report exactly what they say. And, you know, there may come a day when I'll meet them. Who knows?
And what they said basically was to continue to pursue this whole line of thinking that you were making a film, even
right,
though you told them again and again and again,
exactly,
that you weren't.
Exactly. And when I turned up there, it's clear that I don't have cameras or anything like that. Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of humor in here. I would be disturbed if people thought of it as being a book that, in the Bill Bryson tradition, was sarcastic about the people around me.
Yeah, no, that's not really at all what I...
Oh, okay.
No, I was just curious, as a writer, if you change people's
names. Oh, I see
names.
What you're saying. Not in this book. In other books, I have done a couple of times. In this book, actually, I went to the other extreme. There's several people in here who I want to make sure that I haven't misrepresented in any way, and so I sent them chunks of text. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Faith asked me to change something that was true, but her son doesn't know that he was adopted.
Mm.
And so she asked, is it possible that I could take that out? And I thought, sure, why not? I mean, they're going to choose the moment to tell him.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm,
he shouldn't learn about it at third hand.
Mm-hmm.
But in the past, I've definitely changed names of people whom I was going to use for comic purposes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One thing that I thought was interesting was that the Air Force has a job description of combat weatherman.
Yep.
And they're considered high-value targets, and so they won't allow you to use their name.
Yes, exactly. Well, you
what's a combat weatherman? Explain that again.
He's a gray beret. these are people who... Okay, so let's suppose you are in a country like Afghanistan, for example, where you've got mountains, you've got a lot of exposed rock, which means you're going to have all kinds of unpredictable wind currents and weathers mm-hmm. in various places. And let's suppose that you want to either drop some special forces under cover of darkness, or you want to observe something important that's going on, or you want to send in some kind of pilotless vehicle. The weather needs to be well known in an extraordinarily specific way. In a particular wadi or gully or whatever, mm-hmm. the fact that the wind is blowing this way rather than that way may be central to the entire operation. And so what they do, these people, they parachute in behind enemy lines. They set up these little tripod things, which are about 3 or 4 feet tall, that are basically a complete weather station that takes all the information they need and send it back up to a satellite. And that way, you know, they can predict much, much more accurately exactly what the weather is going to be, or even they know more accurately what the current conditions of the weather are.
Every part of the world,
wherever they need to go. Yes, and it was fascinating but scary.
Yeah, very. I don't want to run out of time without asking you about the Champlain College Publishing Initiative. So, can we take a few minutes just to talk about what that is and how it came to be?
At the moment, it's a group of students, a core group of about 15 and a total of about 80, who are involved in real-world publishing activities based on the Champlain campus. And typically what that means is that we have a project that we are helping with in some respect. Usually I'm in overall charge, although in a couple of cases that's not true. And the idea is that because the world of writing and of publishing is changing so rapidly, if you don't have one foot on that train, by the time you graduate, the train will already be 18 stations down the road and you'll be, you know, out of a job and kind of hopelessly lost. So, for example, right now we have two students. They've been given the term staff writers. They're working on work-study money, federal work-study money. They're working for the Vermont Mozart Festival. Mm-hmm. The Mozart Festival wants to put together a documentary and a coffee table book. And the first step to doing that is going to be to interview a number of people who've worked with the festival or have been volunteers or board members for a number of years. They don't have the staff to do that. We're also about to do something very similar with the Jazz Festival, the Burlington mm-hmm. Discover Jazz Festival. So under those circumstances, we really do two things. One is we act as sort of consultants by saying, have you thought of using your website in this way? Have you thought of having a blog to coincide with those events for this purpose? So that's just kind of bringing 21st century thinking to the project. And then we provide personnel. Two people going to work with are working with the Mozart Festival. At least two people are going to work with the Jazz Festival. And if it's a book project, then we'll also pull in a designer. It was one of our students, a senior in the graphic design major, who designed this cover and just did a fantastic job.
On 30% chance
yep,
of enlightenment.
Lindsay Webster. Also the interior design and layout and that kind of thing. If it's a web project, then we're probably going to want somebody who has really a strong web background. Mm-hmm. Chances are we'll also have, we have a publicist, for example, who's in the PR program here. She is involved in all kinds of publicity activities, and she's a sophomore, yeah.
Okay. Wow.
And the thing about these these students is that pretty much I handpick them, and then I give them tasks which they've never done before. And so with Alicia, the publicist, for example, we were helping to self-publish books by two of our students, one a book of poems, one a play. And I said, okay, so in marketing terms, we want to have these people on television. We want to have them interviewed. And so RETN downtown says, okay, so we'll have them interviewed. Who's going to do the interviewing? And I could have done it, but I'm thinking, no, somebody should do this and learn from it. So I said to Alicia, have you ever interviewed anyone on television before? And she said, no. And I said, okay, so you're doing that next week. We have a great student called Trish Tomlins, who is the editorial assistant for the whole operation. And she says, oh, I'm terrible with computers. I just break them. I say, okay, so I want you to go online and find out how to do the following thing on our website. And, you know, she gulps and blinks, and bless her, you know, in 24 hours, she's figured out how to do it. So the things that they learn and they get involved in are not things they could possibly do in class. They are real-world activities, so they recognize that there are consequences and there are standards. It's not just for a grade. It's for, a real thing. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, I mean, Lindsay Webster is graduating in May, and she will have five books in her hand that she's designed. You know, she can... Nobody at 21, 22 years old has five books that they've designed. They can walk and say, this is my work.
Yeah. Now, just to clarify for listeners who are writers, is Champlain accepting submissions for publication of books?
To clarify, we're not publishers. We are working to help people publish their book or their website or their whatever it is they're doing.
Okay.
So the word publishing is a very broad thing. We're starting a publishing course in the fall, and we want to have two projects to work on for that class. And I'm pretty certain I've got both of the projects I want for that.
Mm-hmm.
And but at some point, we're going to be looking ahead to other projects beyond that. We're looking for something really quite complex. Instead of someone saying, here's my book, help me publish it, what we're doing is we're looking for someone to say, here is this thing which could be a book. What else could it be? How can I think about this as a publishing project in the 21st century?
Mm-hmm.
And I can turn around to my students and I can say, okay, that's the question. Here's the idea. Where does it go?
And based on the nature of the project or what it's about, that will change those answers.
And also based on developments in our understanding and developments in technology, developments mm-hmm. in print on demand, developments in use of the web, social networking, all that kind of stuff, yes.
Okay. Well, great.
One thing I did want to make clear is that
okay.
at the moment, people cannot buy this in stores, although that's going to change shortly.
Right, it's not on Amazon, I noticed.
Right, and that's because Amazon, if I sold this on Amazon, I would lose $2.50 for every copy I sold.
That
they take such a huge chunk. That is going to change, but for the time being, people can get it by going to www.30percentchance.com.
It has its own little website. And that's 30 spelled out.
30 spelled out.
Okay, that's good to know. I have one more question
yeah.
for you. And it's the same question I asked you last time we spoke, and maybe you'll have the same answer, maybe you'll have a different answer. I'm not going to remind you what your answer was last time. But for writers who sometimes get stuck in their work, this is always my last question.
Mm.
What advice might you have for them?
I'm actually in the process of doing a book called First Time Author, which is going to address a number of these things. So I have multiple answers, but I'll come up with two right now.
Okay.
If you get stuck with what you're doing, one of the things that can mean is that you don't know your subject well enough yet. You still have questions and areas of confusion, and so you literally, you can't see your way through to the end of what it is that you want to do. And 30% Chance is a great example of that. That sat around for 3 years because I couldn't figure out what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to affect the ending, it's going to affect what you include and don't include, etc., etc. So I'm a great fan of that Bob Dylan line, I'm going to know my song well before I start singing. If you understand, in a general sense, what it's all about, then you can figure out what to write and how to write it. If the ideas are still so new and are causing confusion or conflict inside you, anything you write is going to head off in different directions or is going to break off halfway. So That's one way in which you can get stuck. Another way in which you can get stuck is that you've created a structure which doesn't work for your content. In other words, you say to yourself, it's this kind of book, or it's this kind of piece of writing, without having questioned whether that's the right structure for what you're trying to do. And then, all of a sudden, you're trying to pack an octopus into a pillbox. You know, there's too many things that don't work. And unfortunately, a lot of people never think in these terms, and so they think, it must be because I'm a bad writer. It must be because I don't know how to write, etc. And I'm a great believer in not choosing your structure until you have a clear sense of your content. If you say this is a novel, but it should be a screenplay. If you say this is a piece of journalism, but it really should be a memoir, then you're creating what may be impassable barriers for yourself. And the worst part is you may not realize that that's why you're stuck. And so you'll then pick on other reasons, which are usually unhelpful.
That's a good one. That's good. Thank you very much.
What did I say last time?
Last time, it was a little bit related to what you said this time at the first thing. But you were actually sort of suggesting that sometimes writers are avoiding their subject matter by fencing off the material, and maybe it's something that they feel emotional about, maybe it's something that they just aren't ready to deal with
yet. That absolutely can happen as well, yeah.
Yeah. So it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Tim Brooks. You can read more about his work at his own website, timbrooksinc.com. That also has links to the Champlain Publishing Initiative work. And you can read about the Endangered Alphabets Project at the website endangeredalphabets.com. Write the Book and the Radiator are supported in part by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com. Burlington's fiber optic gigabit network, and by VCAM, with a mission to enrich civil discourse in the Chittenden County region by providing local citizens with access to training and state-of-the-art digital media tools as a means of personal, political, and artistic self-expression. More information at vermontcam.org. Today's Write the Book prompt is inspired by the Endangered Alphabets Project, which Tim Brooks founded and I think still manages. Think back to some aspect of your own life that was once important to you or to an entire community, but disappeared or ended for some reason. This could be a tradition, a celebration, a place, a sports team, a family recipe, a song. It doesn't have to be as important an issue as an entire language and its alphabet that's going extinct, although if you have such an inspiration, go with that. Write about this aspect of your life that was vital to you, and then write about how you lost it and what that has meant for you. And also write about if it exists anymore in any form for anyone else. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And please do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.